Conciliums with Pete and Charlie.
I'm Pete.
I'm Charlie.
The unity of knowledge.
That and a whole bunch of caffeine is what's going to get us through this.
Pete, last week we went out with a whimper, not with a bang.
Okay, well, you can't bring it every day, man.
I think that's the definition of professional, is it not?
And now it's the... It's the emerald version of our continued review of Michael Roth's Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters. So I'll start with BAM!
Are you going to put some celery, onion, and garlic in there?
Season it and...
Get the Trinity? Is that the Trinity?
I don't...
Celery, onion, and...
Really? Is that the Trinity of seasons? Seasoning?
I'm going to back away from the cooking talk.
Okay.
So we finished last week... Kind of in a muddle. We were trying to picture the opponents
of liberal education.
Of liberal education. We're talking about Michael S. Roth's Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters, mm-hmm. a book that came out in 2014 from Yale University Press.
I think a lot of the opponents are people that oppose the way we do education now. And I will say this, and I've said it before, we are in a crisis in this country because we have killed vocational training.
Is it a crisis that's been ongoing? Or
yeah,
do you feel
it's
like
been
it's
ongoing
right
for 20 or 30 years. And I saw it when we took...
I mean this sincerely. Is that still a crisis?
Yeah.
Not is it still bad, but if something goes on for 30 years, isn't that like... The nature of the sin, isn't that?
Yeah, I guess
how
I can't
things
use the word crisis. It means we're screwed, and we've been so for many decades.
Well, I think that the American culture is built somehow to continuously debate the necessity of philosophy versus vocation, or philosophy versus practice.
Right. And let's take a step back from the university. There is a need for vocational training, and this is one of the arguments that was made here. And Roth makes the argument that many people believe that we've diluted the value of a college education because we're trying to merge them together. No better example exists than in Southern Polytechnic University in Marietta, Georgia, which is right near my house.
And it's slowly being absorbed or has been absorbed by Kennesaw.
But the mere fact that Georgia Tech is not a university and Southern Poly is a university is ironic beyond understanding. I don't even know what Southern Poly used to be called, but it used to be
Southern
vocational
Tech.
Training.
It was Southern Tech.
Vocational training and, sort of practical things like, this is where we train people that would do electrician work and do, machinists, things like that.
How long has DeVry been around?
Ooh, DeVry's been around for decades, actually. DeVry is actually a very good model of vocational training that expanded into the university realm. Just like Roth was talking about, we have diluted the university degree because we have said, oh, yeah, this is where people don't get vocational training. Vocational training is where you get this. And vocational training now seems like a second-tier job. People that got vocational training and went to work for GM 30 years ago make more money than I do
and
now in real dollars.
Could be, at this point, it could be things like building solar panels, right?
So, electricians, HVAC people, we have now taken this training and we've turned it into a degree called engineering technology. I don't even know what that degree is. The people that give that degree argue about what it is. And that's what Southern Poly gives now. They give a four-year degree, not in engineering, but in engineering technology. It is this diluted thing that they can attach the label of a college degree to it. But it's in between, and
I don't know. There's a lot of really good professors at Southern Poly.
I'm not saying this. Southern Poly does some really good stuff. In fact, I know some guys at Southern Poly and we're talking about the same guy, Pete.
Pete Rarba.
Yeah, he's doing really cool stuff.
Hi, Pete.
But he should be, well, now he's going to be at Kennesaw State. He should be somewhere else. And I'm going to say this now. I'm going to go beyond what Roth said and say...
You're going to go beyond the university?
Not only...
Are you going to go beyond?
Do you need... What are you doing? Star Trek movie titles here?
Are you going to go outside...
Shut your pie hole.
Past the pale?
Damn it, Jim. I'm just a doctor. Is it past the pale or beyond the pale?
It's beyond the pale, yeah.
So...
Do you know the origin of that?
No. but I'm sure you're going to give it to me now, whether I like it or not.
This is a factoid. The Pale describes the area that was sort of under the protection of the Lord and was developed. Mm-hmm. So if you went beyond the Pale, that's where you might end up getting met by the
highwaymen.
Not even the highwaymen, but like the really serious painted blue, naked, eviscerate you kind of folks.
So like the Visigoths and the Vandals.
So
the...
what would happen beyond the Pale is that really terrible things would happen. So if you go beyond the Pale, right. It's less that
so
was
this
beyond
is a
the
feudal
pale.
Times reference.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that.
And just to cite that fully, complete factoid. Don't know if it's true.
Okay. So, and this book talks about the fact that you need this broad education.
I'm actually painted blue from the neck
down. I'll try to give you an example.
That?
And he's wearing a kilt and he's waving his genitals at me saying, Aaron, go bra!
Just like every day, Pete.
Not only do you need this broad education for someone getting a university degree, I think in vocational training, you need it as well. It's just that the nature of it has changed in modern times, and it will certainly change for a more directed, focused
certainly there's
like
more
vocation.
Vocations. There's more complicated vocations.
Yeah, I mean, I believe that you, even for a university degree, you have no time to take three courses on the Greeks and the Romans and Euripides, and
but,
you have no time to learn Latin and Greek.
You have as much time as we sort of carve out. But we now have,
there's more knowledge. There's more stuff. Unless we start making, I mean, it was what, close to 100 years ago that we agreed that the doctorate was the terminal degree for most liberal areas.
But wait, this is where you change what the classes really are, right? Instead of saying, I had a Shakespeare class, which was quite good, but it was specifically the tragedies, and it was a deep dive into each of the four that we did. And the guy was like, here's what people have decided. Was the meaning. I am giving you the majority opinion of why Hamlet did this. And it was real just sort of, you know, he was very chatty and very performative, and he just delivered, right? Instead of that, a Shakespeare class now can be, here's who Shakespeare is. Here is the beginnings of understanding why he's important, right? And here are some of the top scholars. Here are some of the remnants of Shakespeare in modern times. You know, did you know that this movie is, Shakespeare-based? Right. Here's what people are doing with Shakespeare productions now.
So had you not interrupted me, you would have realized we were agreeing with each other.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
No, that's what I'm saying. You can't take one class on the tragedies and one class on the comedies and do this sort of thing. And then learn Greek and Latin.
Were you going to say those three classes should be one, Pete? Is that what you were going to say?
Basically, yeah.
You son of a bitch.
Well, you jumped in, you pompous, arrogant academic, you.
you grease
and
monkey,
in vocational
blue collar.
Training. So I've thought about this a lot. I've always thought, oh, this blows. I should just quit and start a vocational training institute. And in that vocational training institute,
because of the understanding that you could get a job, you could just step out and there would be a job waiting for you. If you knew how to repair air conditioners, there's always going to be hot weather.
Right. But what I would do is I would supplement it with additional classes. And I would have classes on,
one class on the Greek tragedies?
I would have a few classes on other stuff that are more broad that you don't think you need to learn as a with HVAC, heating, ventilation, and air conditioning is the standard acronym, repair person, but you do. And there would be a class on the business of that. And then there would be a class of interacting with people if you're trying to give a quote. For example, a mistake
that was... You're talking
about
emotional intelligence.
Oh, yeah. So that's what I'm saying. So you would look back at sociology and psychology, and you'd get little snippets of what is relevant. There would be, the business of this. There would be the math of this. There would be, the importance of the narrative and talking to your customer. And you would go back to the narrative, and you would look at literature. Now, it would be much smaller at a vocational school for HVAC.
I think it's got to be starting points.
And it would be broader for a university education. And, of course, it would be much broader for someone who was getting a PhD in literature
that. You would get the terminal degree and also the terminal reading.
Yeah, there's just not room for me to read all the Greek classics and learn Latin. But there is room for me to – so I'm going to agree with Dewey on this. Dewey said that you shouldn't study history for history's sake. You should study history to provide perspective and enlightenment on the present and where we're going with the future. And the problem is we still teach, and Roth did not address this, the way we teach blows. I'm going to say it right now. My understanding of history is more informed by passionate teachers that I've had. Actually, a guy by the name of Hank Hockey was his name. Not H-O-C. I think it's like H-A-K-K-E. He was my U.S. honors U.S. history teacher my junior year. And a lot of my friends who are very smart people really liked him as well. And, you know, he told us about how colleges were closed down in the 60s yeah. because of the Vietnam War. He made the bastard. We talked about slavery and the Civil War.
Why was he a bastard?
Well, because he did something that was very, very smart. And by the way, one of the points that Roth makes is that, you know, there's a trend toward, well, we should do what the students want us to do and want us to teach them. No. There's a great essay called The
Why'd
Student...
Why'd you give it that voice?
Well, because whenever I talk like a snooty academic...
Yeah, but what do you think of when you think of we should give the students what they want us to give them? Like, what's the sort of...
Because they don't always know what they want. Because they'll say things like, why do we need to take this course if I'm going to be an HVAC repairman?
Right.
And now we ought to be able to explain why.
I'm a
little
more
distressed.
But we
ought to get people excited and passionate. Yeah. So
I'm a little more distressed by the kids who do the whole, well, you know, technically you work for me kind of thing.
Yeah, and that's why there's a great essay called The Student as a Customer that points out, yes, they are a customer in the sense that they are paying for and they deserve quality education, but it doesn't mean we have to deliver easy A's and easy classes
You're not
and the stupid crap that they want
for their education.
Yeah. But yeah, so sometimes you have to say, look, you need to learn this, but it can't be you need to learn this because I did this, and I'm trying to justify my existence. You better be able to justify it in a much broader way. Dewey makes that point, and I agree with Dewey.
There was a little anecdote about Howard Zinn that really kind of it made a few things click about how we should treat the study of subjects. You remember who Howard Zinn is?
No.
Oh.
I remember him vaguely.
A People's History of America, or People's History of the United States. He wrote essentially a counterweight to... the sort of colonial empire history books, you know, the white people's history.
Okay.
Right. So he wrote a people's history, you know, folks who were not Jefferson.
Right.
Right. It was, I think, a very powerful book. And for the time, I think it blew a lot of people's minds, you know, thinking about, oh my God, you know, the slaves were not some monolithic entity that made things happen. They were people,
right?
And they were groups of people, and they, you know, all that.
And so, it was a very diverse experience. Yeah.
So someone went to Howard Zinn, and I think this was a famous person. Anyway, all details of the anecdote don't matter. The person went to Howard Zinn, and they said, "I love your work, and I love you. I've read The People's History of the United States 5-6 times." And Zinn said, you know, nicely, he said, "Oh, well, probably time to read some more history books then, right?" Because for him, what his deal was not, here's the book. His was, look, this must be added to the dialogue.
Yeah. Here this is an interesting perspective that along with the other perspectives
here
are
is
very
a,
important.
A point, counterpoint, right? The point is what's being delivered. Here's the counterpoint. And I hope that it sort of in thesis, antithesis, synthesis.
But if you agree with Bloom,
I don't.
Oh, I do agree with
Except that he's really compelling, because it's so compelling to be indignant. Did we
Wait, it's so compelling to be a what?
Indignant. Alan Bloom.
Oh, yes. The he does talk American about mind. Critique.
He strides
fact,
into the room
yeah,
and says,
critique for critique's
all of you
sake
are fools.
Is ridiculous. That you need to critique, but then you need to understand the other view. And that talks about this blindness that William James talks about, that we get too arrogant. But I think so. Okay, so let me give you what I mean by liberal education. Now.
Give it to me,
and
Pete.
And we are an engineering institution that is dominated by engineering, and to a lesser degree by science.
Except, you know what? In this room, 50-50.
It is. But and somewhere in here they use the phrase "the unity of knowledge." Oh, I left that note page, and I'm like, yeah, the unity. No, that really is. It is the unity of knowledge, and I saw that. On this Advances in Cognitive Systems thing where we talk about humans and how they think and how they teach and learn via the narrative, and we have these goofy-ass mathematicians, computer science people who, if they want to capture that, have to understand it. It is the ultimate in liberal education. And I will say this, Albert Lee, who's a
guitarist.
L-I. His name's Bojan Lee, but he goes by Albert. He now works for Disney, and he did his PhD here.
Did you say he works for Disney?
He works for Disney. He's a cognitive science, computer science geek who worked for Mark Rydell, who had get, and he walked up to me at the thing, and I saw this thing, but I forgot his name. And then I saw him and said, yeah, you're the guy.
Your weekend of cognitive
psych. Yeah, you're the guy that gave a talk in our Humor Genome Project. And I have to say this. And actually, I believe that Albert may have come up with a very broad theory about humor and how it pertains to us categorizing it, understanding
that
it, and using it for creativity.
And now you have to kill him to make sure you can hold on to the idea.
I don't think there is a complete theory on this. But he has added something that helps me explain an argument that I got in with Pete McGraw, the author of The Humor Code, co-author of The Humor Code. And it's very fascinating. I sent the paper to my student who's working in the summer on Saturday. I said, look at this paper. Let's talk about it next week because I think this has, you know, this helps us understand something more. And we're trying to use math to understand and to characterize how humor works because I think humor is important for education. I met another researcher who, like Lou Lufton and I, believe it's important for creativity. So you talk about you have humor and cognition and history and narrative and human response and functional MRI analysis of how people think and mathematics and linear algebra and functional and computer science and all this together. To me, this illustrates what the modern liberal education means. One word, multidisciplinary. Nowhere in this book does Roth criticize the history of classes saying, well, you take a humanities class, and you take a social science class, and you take a math class. Classes are going to fall apart in the future, and well, they should. Now, that doesn't mean that
How are we going to teach those professors, though? How are you going to...
It's going to be tough.
How are you going to recover the university professor who can, you know, discuss any subject and guide the students? Like, I can talk shit about almost anything. Right, but I'm no professor. I'm not going to be a useful, you know, guiding light of education if you toss me in and I have to start talking crap about chemical engineering.
Okay, well, so that's actually quite easy. The attitude you don't have to change is you don't have to say magically make us Renaissance folks. What you do is you have co-taught classes. And Roth did stress the change of us going to co-curricular and extracurricular stuff, things outside the traditional classroom. Now, the traditional classroom is going to be a course co-taught by two people from disparate fields, or three, or four.
Yeah.
And we have done that. And there are people on campus who, at least just, let's just take engineering, right? Because we're a big engineering school. Nobody designs cool stuff by just being an electrical engineer or a mechanical engineer or a chemical engineer. They don't. Really cool, interesting things happen when you have several engineers and a couple scientists and a business guy and a policy guy.
We talked about Asimov. Remember that?
Yeah.
Principles of Cerebration.
Yeah.
The idea of, you know, people bringing fact clusters and fact connections and tossing them to each other.
But what it means is you can't be this arrogant, pompous guy who comes in and lectures. You teach a course with someone else, and the first time you teach the course, you're learning from them, they're learning from you, the students are learning, you're learning from the students on how they take it all in. When it's new like this, that's how it starts. Now, sometimes that evolves into a new field. So let me pick one of my favorite ones, material science. You know, four decades ago, material science didn't really exist. And the first professors of material science at places like MIT were metallurgy guys and chemists and physicists and electrical engineers and mechanical engineers who studied material properties. And now we have an undergraduate and a graduate degree in material science. Material science is extremely important. We even have subsets of that. We have polymer science.
Yeah.
Right, we have ceramics, things like that. You start it by working with people in different fields. And let me just tell you this. This is true for the students, and this is true for the faculty. That's where the fun starts.
What do you mean by fun?
I mean, to me, that's the fun part of liberal education. It's not sitting around going, well, you should also learn Greek tragedies as well. Where the fun starts is when you teach the course together. Say, for example, we have someone who does do the history of Greek tragedies, and we have someone that teaches modern theater. And we talk about the evolution when we had the chorus and one person in a Greek tragedy. Then, lo and behold, you know, like the musical, big innovation, they had two people in dialogues in the Greek tragedy. And what were they thinking? You know, why did they only want one person? What was the advantage of two? And then how we go through genres of theater and things like that, like the rock opera.
Why are you calling that fun, though? And how do you then apply that? Because in a way, I hear you saying that, yeah, that's fun because then we get to talk about performance and theater and Greek
tragedy. Well, because the instructors get to learn something, too.
Ah, so the fun for you.
Yeah.
Fun for you as a professor.
I think it's fun for the students because they get to see the learning process with faculty. The other thing is, I'm going to go to a definition of knowledge.
Why isn't it fun for students to learn something new?
That's a different problem that we may have to address on a different day.
Okay, and
that
is that, hold on to that one.
Because we have these classes and these scores and this assessment that's fairly rigid, students at Georgia Tech and other places really just care about their GPA.
You read Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance?
I haven't read that.
There's a section, there's a chapter on when Persig taught a gradeless class. Mm-hmm. And he describes the sort of the A students immediately flourish. They're like, cool. And the B students are like, all right, you know. And the C students all sit back and say, no, this isn't how I work things. And the D and the F students aren't there anyway.
Yeah.
You know, or aren't paying attention anyway.
Yeah.
And then he sort of charts their psychological reality throughout the class, how eventually the A students are brimming with ideas, exploding
right, because they're learning because they're excited about learning.
And the C students
and no
are
longer just the grade.
Frantically trying to figure out what to do. And the D and the F students have actually started to say, well, what the hell is this all about?
Yeah, they probably would give the teacher a bad review saying, well, there was no grade. What's the point?
I do remember in the Moby Dick class that I was embedded librarian for.
Right. And liberals have tried this for years.
One of the students
no
said, I just don't understand how I'm supposed to get a good grade in this class. I don't understand it.
Right. So we're obsessed with grades. We're obsessed with assessment. You can't completely throw out assessment because we did that back in the 50s and the 60s, and we had other problems, right?
The Watts riots?
No, I'm not blaming. Were the Watts riots blamed on lack of grades? Man, you're reaching now. So I don't know what the optimum is. So we need to rethink assessment and grades. We need to rethink the fact that many major universities measure time on task. You're here for 4 years. You get a bunch of grades.
Yeah.
As opposed to, I'm trying to think, what's the basis for it? It's competency-based.
In a way, grades are to make sure someone doesn't come here, pay Georgia Tech money, and then walk out saying, now I'm an expert, even though they didn't do anything
right,
for four
exactly.
years. Or seven.
But we need to
nine.
Take maybe a more liberal approach to assessment. I'm struggling with it now.
This is a credential. That's the thing. This is a credential that someone essentially doesn't have to prove for a little while when they leave it, right? As opposed to before, where you'd go to school and you didn't stride up to the corporate office and say, notice my degree from Harvard, and please give me an office. Which I think might have happened at one point or another. The sort of
and that is something that
Roth
points
right
out.
Excellent,
it's
very
the,
good.
The connections
guys.
And the thing.
Yeah,
yeah. Exactly.
And so that's why grades are important in terms of after the education.
Completely getting rid of assessment is an issue. But you make a point that maybe we are evolving to credentialing institutions and that we can get it all via MOOCs on the web.
Come on.
No, I don't think that's practical, but these ideas have been discussed in the Center for 21st Century Universities here on this campus.
The C21U?
Yeah, the C21U. Is that it?
C21U?
Yeah. We've talked
Sounds
about the
like
fact that maybe we're
store.
Only going to do the second 2 years of a bachelor's degree, that you'll do the first 2 years online. There
when?
Are advantages and disadvantages
time?
Of that. Because it'll make it more accessible so people can work and do it at their own pace.
So you're saying you graduate high school, you go to Europe for 3 months, right?
Oh, that'd be nice. I can afford it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, when is this online bachelor's degree get started?
It started now. We have an online master's
degree.
No,
listen. Take the person who just graduated from high school and tell me what their life is like. They graduate from high school, and now what do they do?
Can you go to the C21U site here? And let me tell you who the person is you need to ask. And we need to get him as a guest on this show. This is our current – see if we can find the scholar in residence. Do we have a scholar in residence? a really cool guy who gave a talk at the C21 University.
What's his name?
Meeting. I'm trying to remember. But he worked for a while with the U.S. News and World Report people about making that ranking. And he said there are so many interesting things about that ranking, some of them just stupid. Look up staff.
Maybe Michael Higgins?
Future of the Campus of the Digital World. That's him. And he talked about how at the beginning...
J. Michael Haggins, H-A-G-G-A-N-S.
Yeah. Right, and so he wrote this book, right? Future of the Campus and Digital World. Isn't that his book?
Or is that just I think that's the paper that he...
Oh, okay. He talked about that. So he talked about the new path that people take via the digital world. There it is, the future of the campus and the digital world. This is a guy who said already there are some people that are taking this path, right? Yeah, it's already here. It's too late.
What is the path? I don't
understand.
No,
and the path is some weird combination of... digital courses and classroom courses. So digital courses now, there are places out there that do a really, really good job. I mean, Khan Academy is free. Code Academy is what I'm using to teach my son Python. And it's actually quite good, and other folks have recommended it to me. But there are other things out there that will do these online courses. Many of them are deep immersion courses, right, which people agree is the best way to learn a language. Ironically, it's the best way to learn a computer language, in my opinion, no?
I don't think that's ironic at all.
And these are not cheap. You pay a pretty penny for these things.
C21U.gotech.edu.
So this is already happening. We should discuss this on another day.
All right. I got to read that now.
Yeah, but classrooms... the traditional classroom is going to die.
That's cool and all, yeah. But I feel like it's a hard argument to make when we can't say what the expectation is. Like, you've been avoiding the question because you say that this person has a better idea. But like, someone graduates high school, mm-hmm. What do they do right now? What should they do?
They take advantage of 20 different paths. 20 different, and this guy actually went through about 6 different versions of what this path looks like. And it's a combination of working, and it's a combination of internships, and online, and in-classroom courses, and things like that. But so when someone suggested that Georgia Tech should really concentrate on the last 2 years...
offering them those 20 paths? So much of high school is so directed, right down to the guidance counselor, the counselor of guidance.
I was not prepared to answer that question, but there is an online group that teaches computer science that I actually thought about taking one of their courses that was so cool that Haggins in this lecture actually put it. I'd have to go look at my notes. I wasn't prepared to discuss that.
You have all these notes.
No, but
you
these are notes so on Michael S. Roth's book. But yeah, it's changing. And if we do not change with it... we will fall by the wayside.
I'm going to take this book. Yeah. I'm going to start reading it again.
Okay.
And the interesting thing about this book is that it took both of us like 3 months to read it.
Yeah.
I
actually read half of it this weekend.
It doesn't seem like it should take a while, but it does.
No, it doesn't. We're just busy guys.
that sounds so highfalutin.
This is Consilience with Pete and Charlie, a podcast about the intersection of science and the humanities.
The unity of knowledge. I always like to say that part.
You can find us on Facebook, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, and you can always get in touch with me or Pete if you look on Twitter and other social media.
And can you also find us on Tumblr at peteandcharlie.tumblr.com.
Thank you.